Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne, and with me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
Alyssa can't join us today, but joining us instead is a special guest. We have with us today Dr. Laura Heflin to talk to us about intelligence testing.
Hi.
So we usually, as I guess kind of a tradition, let our, you know, outside of their name, let our guests introduce themselves so that we don't mess up some important aspect of your background.
Okay. So I'm Dr. Laura Heflin. I'm a neuropsychologist, which basically means I'm a kind of psychologist who's really interested in brain behavior relationships. And we use things like IQ tests and cognitive tests and other tests of emotion and emotional functioning to understand people's brain behavior relationships and the real world functioning.
And it's so good. We have been, I don't know if I want to say fair and balanced when it comes to neuroscience.
Yeah, that's fair.
That
yeah, I mean, Thomas, we talked about like how, you know, is this kind of, you know, the new phrenology? And yeah.
Yeah, we've had those conversations, but have not actually had someone kind of tangentially related to neuroscience, which is good. We should. So we don't necessarily have to preface, well, we don't really have the background, but this is our understanding, and this is some of the stuff in the field. So,
and it's been a very much outside looking in kind of process.
And yeah, that's fair.
And it's nice to get another perspective too, because we have talked about intelligence like twice before, but it has been very
historical.
Historical, yes.
Well, I'm glad you've covered that part, because I don't know, like, I know the basics of the historical context of IQ tests, but, you know, like I was telling Daniel, a lot of the way we use IQ tests as neuropsychologists is not really the way they're intended to be used. So my understanding and the things that I can talk about IQ tests are, you know, to the left of what the field says.
And I think I don't know if I can speak for Thomas. I'm excited about talking about that.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm happy not to talk about eugenics for a fourth episode.
So, to be fair, the Kellogg episode was fun.
It was a lot of fun. Kellogg is a interesting person. So I guess first off, we've talked at least about some of the historical basis in previous episodes, but we haven't really touched on, I guess, sort of the nature of the modern intelligence test, or I guess what options are available for someone who's going to take something beyond, let's say, a Facebook what is your IQ test.
Yeah, so the more modern IQ tests for adults would include like the WACE, which is now in the fourth edition. That's the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale. And then the Woodcock-Johnson. Those are probably the two that are the most commonly used. And I'm most familiar with the WACE. That's the one I've used the most. I guess I should take some online IQ tests so that I can do a fair contrast, because I don't know that I can give justice to that side of things, but I'll describe the way that like the WACE works. And then anyone who's done an online test can do the contrast for themselves.
I mean, I'm thinking that's where the people type on the internet that they've got like a 250 IQ, and it just seems off to me.
Well, yeah, that's pretty statistically improbable. Like if you look at where that would be on the normal curve, I'm not sure that IQs even go up there, like just the scores. So I'm not sure that that's a valid score at all. I have to check my conversion chart.
So it's been, I think, a decade now since I've gotten to administer a WACE. I took one class with my master's degree. And I gave it to a friend of mine, and I ended up scoring it. I was like, you got to take this with a grain of salt, because, and then he was like, I thought I'd get higher. And I'm like, well, sorry to tell you. But what's involved in, I guess, sort of the modern WACE, the modern intelligence test that someone would take?
Yeah, the modern waste has a lot of different components because it's like there's this idea that we'll set aside this idea that we understand what IQ is for a second. But, you know, to the extent that we think we understand that intelligence is a more or less unitary construct, we also think that it's comprised of a lot of different kind of sub-constructs. And so there's lots of different kinds of tests in there, and the test tends to switch back and forth between subtests that test like verbal functioning versus visual functioning. There's tests of attention and processing speed. And so usually there's kind of a core group of subtests that you have to give to get a full-scale IQ score, which is kind of like that composite overall IQ score. And then you can give some extra tests too to try to measure it better, get more accurate IQ score. So the way the subtests work is they're designed so that people don't get 100%, right? They're designed to get harder and harder and harder until basically everyone starts failing. So this is irritating because everyone feels like they're doing badly on the test because they just keep going until you fail a certain number of times. And then it's like, okay, let's move on to the next subtest. And then that one will proceed until you fail a certain number of times. And then you move on to the next test. So it switches back between these different subtests with these kind of continuous failure experiences. But the better you're doing on them, the longer it takes because you get more and more items until you kind of fail off into the next test. So it can also be a really long and grueling process. So, you know, pretty fun.
To my friend's credit, we did take a little longer. Like he did break 100.
Hey, you don't have to disclose
at least
anything
a standard deviation, you know. I want to at least give them credit. Like I'm not saying like, oh, you know, 40 on the IQ test. Hey, they did well. It just
So would you say that because there's different components within the waste, are they weighed differently, or when you do the composite, are they, you know, are they equally weight in terms of what that final result is?
The core tests are equally weighted. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And they tend to
Sorry, I realize I'm like, man, I haven't given like a full IQ test for the purpose of air quotes IQ in like a decade at least, because that's just, you know, not how I use them.
Right.
But yeah, my recollection is that they're all equally weighted.
Okay. So I guess just to contextualize for me, what is the difference between kind of the traditional IQ test utility versus what you use it for then?
So the way I use it is I don't worry too much about the overall score. I'm much less interested in that because oftentimes when you can like look at discrepancy scores. So you can calculate individual subtest scores, and different subtests will load on to kind of broader composite measures like verbal intelligence and visuospatial functioning and processing speed. And I'm more interested in those kind of like those component measures or the individual subtest scores, because you can do analyses that kind of compare different subtests or compare those kind of subcomposite like VIQ, the verbal IQ versus performance IQ. And oftentimes, at least with the people who I tend to work with, they're not comparable. They're not at the same level. And that suggests that, you know, intelligence, again, using air quotes, isn't really a unitary construct for a lot of people. There's too much variability within the scores. So I tend to use them like in neuropsychology to just look at what information I'm getting from the specific subtest. And because I am a process approach neuropsychologist, which I'd be happy to describe if you're interested, we really look at not just the overall test score, but also how people solve the problems, like how people go about reaching that, because there's a lot of information that you can glean. And there's a lot of research that's been published on this to kind of show what parts of the brains people are using and what their skills and deficits might be by the way they approach a test that just gets totally obscured if you're just looking at the numeric score.
Mm. So process then connotates the actual process that the participant or patient or whoever you're working with is going through to solve the problem then?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you can't see it necessarily on all tests. Like there's some tests that unless people are speaking aloud while they're doing it, you might not be able to see the process. But like one of the most reliable and valid subcomponents of the WACE is a test called the block design, where you have a two-dimensional picture, like kind of geometric picture, and then you have these blocks that have two sides that are all red, two sides are all white, and two sides are half red and half white. And they have to manipulate the blocks to these three-dimensional blocks to recreate the two-dimensional design. And by the way they're turning them and the way the mistakes they make and whether they work from left to right or right to left and top to bottom and how organized they are in their strategies and the kind of errors they make, you can discern patterns that suggest potential areas of deficit. So that's how I like to use it.
No, that seems very comprehensive, as opposed to typically when, at least lay-wise or outside looking in, when we talk about IQ, it's like, what's the score on the distribution? Right. But there's utility within each of the constructs and tasks that you're working with.
Yeah, I don't think one number is a good way. You guys have probably had this discussion already in other IQ podcasts, but like, I don't think one number is a good comprehensive representation of a person. Everyone's got strengths and weaknesses.
It's kind of like taking the, who's the triarchic, is it Gardner? I'm trying to remember my names. with that multiple intelligence approaches. So
Gardner
and others who argue that we have these multiple types of intelligence, and some of us are just garbage at some, but excel at others, and some of us are kind of okay at others, and we can't really judge the composite. And then there's also the, it wasn't Spearman. Where we kind of have that like big G, you know, intelligence, IQ.
Carol, right?
Carol.
It's the last name where it's like three levels, like you have G, and then there's like the subcomponents that kind of are intercorrelated and contribute to G, and then there's like the very individual subcomponents. Yeah.
And so where IQ is kind of like the G, the big G, if we're only focused on the score, then the subtests, and then I kind of get what you're saying. You can even break the subtest down more if we're trying to understand the processes that go into solving that. I guess, could you give us an example of how, I mean, that's what I always think of the block test, because that's one of the few tests that I remember from giving one, that if I were doing the block test, how would the way I approach it, like whether I do it left to right or right to left or something, what would that say about the process? Like, how would we glean something from that?
Yeah, well, I don't think it would say anything about intelligence, but for most right-handed individuals, the right parietal lobe helps us orient left and then right. And then the left parietal lobe just helps us orient to the right. So if someone has damage on the right parietal lobe, they lose the left. They tend to neglect left function. They tend to neglect information in their left visual field. And so you can see that represented when they do block design, they tend to work from right to left. If they do the left at all, they often have inaccuracies in the left. Another example is sometimes people have a lot of difficulty with kind of seeing the gestalt, the big picture. So they will get they'll really focus on the internal details, representing the internal details of the block design, but they'll like break, like the blocks are supposed to, you know, form a square, and they'll make it so that it's not forming a square, kind of like losing the gestalt, losing the big picture, trying to represent the internal details. And we see that a lot when people have right hemisphere damage, that they are overly fixated on the details. And then in contrast, when people have left hemisphere damage, they do the opposite. They get the big picture, but the internal details are awry. They're, you know, not correct. And then sometimes people who have frontal lobe damage will approach the task in a way that's not well organized. They'll fixate, they'll start with kind of the most prominent detail and fixate on that sometimes to the exclusion of the kind of a more organized systematic approach.
So this is where the neuropsych comes in then, where we're not necessarily needing an fMRI to look at these things. We just need the test and then work our way backwards logically to where the problem
is. Yeah, or conversely, you don't need neuropsych anymore if you've got an fMRI.
Oh, right.
Just run the scan.
Yeah, just run the scan. Like, we know there's a tumor in the right hemisphere. You don't need me to tell you that the right hemisphere is not working right.
So there's still a lot of utility in that too, because if, let's say, you need to remove that tumor, these tests also work as a really good metric of, I guess, seeing an improvement or seeing change, or if you're worried about, let's say, a brain surgery going wrong, being able to kind of maintain that same score or similar score post surgery or post procedure, post therapy.
Yeah, I think a lot of neuropsychology is more focused on functioning now in that way. But it's interesting what you say. Sorry, I don't want to turn this into a neuropsych podcast.
No, please.
But like we see, like with surgery for epilepsy, for seizures or seizure disorders, a lot of times they'll give tests like an IQ test before the if you're going to do surgical resection of the part of the brain that's causing the seizures. They'll do lots of testing to make sure that they're not like taking out a language part of the brain and things like that. But then also they'll do oftentimes an IQ test before the surgery and after the surgery. And you'll actually see oftentimes improvements in the IQ scores after the surgery because, you know, they've taken out the problematic brain, the brain that was causing problems, and a person's overall functioning improves. So yeah, you can use IQ tests like that. It's pretty cool.
I was going to track onto my next question. This tracks on to my next question really well, because I taught or went over the NBAC test in my learning class today. And it's an awful test. Like, it's the most frustrating thing I think I've ever experienced. But there I discovered while I was going through kind of like the YouTube videos to kind of get a sense of like, what's the flow? What are the different variants? That there's actually this community, I guess, of people online who are aggressively practicing the NBAC test to improve their intelligence.
Oh, okay.
And so I was like, okay, I can understand like that will improve whatever score you're going to get if you get practice. Like if you can work up to doing like a 6N or a 6BAC test, like that's amazing. But I wonder about the, you know, efficacy of that line of logic. Do we generally see improvements in IQ scores, and do those actually track to like intelligence or functioning or things like that? Or is that kind of in vain?
No, that's such a good question. So, I mean, it's like that gets to this idea, like when, you know, Binet started just, you know, creating intelligence tests, they wanted to test the underlying skills, right? Not things that are taught. So that you're asking kind of the question of like, how much are these tests testing these kind of innate qualities we have versus things that were taught and practiced? And the answer is kind of like both. So a lot of research, I don't know specifically about research on the NMAC, but a lot of research suggests that, you know, if you practice something, you'll get better at that specific thing, but there may not be a lot of generalizing of those skills. So the NBAC is usually conceptualized as a test of working memory. And working memory is a big component of IQ tests. How much does practicing the NBAC actually improve working memory versus improving performance on the NBAC is the question.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. It's an empirical question.
That'd be a fun study.
I don't know the research, but yeah, but there are certainly, I mean, exposure works, right? If you've seen things that are similar to what they're asking you to do on any IQ test, you're gonna have an easier time doing it than someone who's never seen anything like that before. So, I mean, there is some amount of practice effect that's real. And it may not improve your actual intelligence, but it could improve your score.
I it was like beaten into our heads in that assessment class that like you've got to give a wace, but also any wace you take following this is invalid.
That's correct.
And I'm thinking like 12 years out, I could probably go and take a wace now and it would probably hold up. But I mean, there are things, I mean, then again, I guess knowing what to expect is very different than like practicing it. And so like, if I remember like, oh, there is this component, or I understand that there is this component to the wace, but I don't know, I'm not like itching to go and get my IQ score. And then if I was like, I'm not going to sit down for another 2 hours and take another IQ test.
And you know, it would take more than 2 hours, right? Because the better you're doing, the longer it takes.
Yeah, the people who are aggressively taking something like the NBAC test, that like it just makes me think of like someone who wants to go back and take the GRE to get a better score. And I mean, like, I had to do that. I did not want to do it again.
Right. Like maybe someone who's not applying to grad school, they're just like, I know I can bring my score
up. I'm just going to keep paying $200 a pop to take the GRE over and over and 5 hours a day, you know, 5 hour tests in hopes to get better at it. Like I guess if you were really like shooting to get into that gifted program, you can get yourself a copy of the Wace and do some practice runs and put why it would not be valid.
Right. And then what are you doing in the gifted program? Like you're probably, I don't know, struggling.
Yeah. I mean, you are tenacious if you're going to practice the Wace.
Well, you know what? That is an excellent point. They've got grit and that probably contributes a lot.
Yeah, it's gotta account for something. And I mean, it's not to say that like their scores aren't necessarily, like aspects of their scores aren't invalid. But oh man, that's a whole niche I didn't think about, but makes complete sense to me that there's people out there just trying to consistently improve their score.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They work up to a crazy version of the NBAC where they get the auditory letter string at the same time that they get the visual spatial square. And so they'll get like D bottom center, E top center, D top center. And then they have to acknowledge it because it followed the two-back rule for the verbal, but they don't acknowledge it for the visual spatial because it didn't meet the rule. And so they have to keep both rules. And so they train up to that. And I was like, why would you do this?
Wow.
This is awful. This gives me anxiety just watching you try.
Yeah. I mean, that probably, I don't know, maybe that does actually improve working memory. Like that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an IQ test, but there's a neuropsych test called the PACET, the Paced Auditory Serial Attention Test, that is kind of similarly miserable. Like I've literally seen it make grown men cry, where it's like it's on a tape recorder, so you don't you press the button, you don't actually administer it. And the way it works is like it's a voice that says numbers, just single digit numbers, and the examinee's job is to just say what the last two numbers add up to. So it's like 3, 4, and the examinee says 7. And then if it's like 7, you have to add 7 plus 4. Like you have to keep doing the last two numbers and add it. And everyone knows addition. It's simple addition. So you feel like you should do well, but there's 4 trials and each trial gets faster and faster and faster. And on the fourth, oh my gosh, on the fourth trial, you feel like I am an idiot because I can't do basic addition. The only way to do it is to just skip numbers, just to systematically be like every fourth number, I'm just not going to listen to. And I'm just going to let that one go. But I mean, it's similarly just wow. I mean, it's like torture what we're doing. I don't give that test anymore. It was too rough.
It's almost like, and this is a tangential conversation when we talked about like memory metaphors, comparing humans to computers. Like we give these brutal tests that are like, well, a computer could do it. And the computer's just like memory.
Computer's just like memory. I mean, not like human memory, right? I don't know. There's a lot I don't know about computers, but I think that they have superior memories.
Oh, just the general like metaphor of how we conceptualize memory is based on the computer model. So the idea that we encode and store and stuff like that. And that's kind of a remnant of the multidisciplinary like push in the 70s to get like computer science and psychology and linguistics all together in cognition for the revolution. And then psychology just like ate everybody. There's not many multidisciplinary cognitive programs. They're all psychology focused.
Yeah.
But that was kind of like the origins of the computer memory metaphor. And so we're moving away from it in a lot of ways, but it's still very much here. So that reminds me when I think of like that serial task, I'm like, this sounds like we're testing to see how close memory is to a computer.
Yeah, it probably was a test that was made in like the 70s too. So it's just consistent with that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, tangent or not, the social psychologist in me is just like really fascinated now at wanting to study the NBAC people. But also, like, what Milgram level test can I force people to take math questions? There are a lot of ethical considerations, though, that I don't think it would get approved. I'm like, I want to see if I can make people cry, and what's the difference? Like, I don't think that's gonna
fail. No. So to recenter back on your work, now that we're on our tangent, who are the people that you are giving this these tests to? So what is your primary area of interest when it comes to either participants or patients? Because we've talked a little bit about like brain damage, for example. So I'm guessing there's, medical implications to your work then?
Yeah, the way I was mostly using them was in like a population of people who'd had brain injuries. So sometimes people use the IQ tests, like neuropsychologists will sometimes use IQ tests, basically like they're intended to be used, but with this idea that actually after a lot of different kinds of brain injuries, IQ tests actually stay pretty stable. So you can sometimes see problems on individual subtests, especially if you look at the process that people are using, but actually that overall score oftentimes doesn't change significantly in the presence of a lot of different kinds of brain injuries. So sometimes people use the IQ test even after someone has had a brain injury to kind of estimate what their pre-morbid level of functioning was likely to be. So like, oh, okay, so if you were above average, we're going to estimate, you know, you were above average beforehand, and now you're having these other problems. Well, those are probably declines because of your brain injury. So, you know, sometimes I don't like that use all that much because I think it's problematic for a number of reasons, but sometimes we would use them like that, but, you know, mostly, yeah, in a medical population to look at more specific, just kind of basically treating the subtest like they're any other neuropsychological test, just stealing them.
And that's kind of the importance of using the subtest over the global score, is that the subtests give you a lot more insight into where those specific problems, especially like you mentioned, coupled with the process aspect of it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Could I pick apart your opinion on the problematic nature of delivering tests in that particular way a little bit, since I'm not in this field, so I'm not privy to these conversations. What do you mean by problematic and what are those implications?
Well, you know, like it does. So if you're giving someone an IQ test to estimate their pre-morbid level of functioning, you've got this assumption that their pre-morbid level of functioning was pretty global, was like a, you know, that it assumes that IQ is a pretty unitary construct and that it's consistent with their overall level of cognitive functioning. And those assumptions don't hold up really well in research. Like if you, you know, to some extent, this is kind of type one error, but if you give people enough tests, they're going to show deficits on some. Everyone has strengths and weaknesses. And this is common sense. Like everyone probably has had the experience where you're in school and there's subjects you like and there's subjects you don't like. You like the subjects you're good at and you don't like the subjects that you find more challenging. And that's normal because people aren't either just smart or not smart. I mean, it's right. We all have, you know, varying levels. So this idea that IQ gives one level and this is the level that you're at and anything below that is a decline from how you should be functioning is problematic for those reasons. And then too, some kinds of brain injuries and disorders do affect subtest scores. I mean, if you know, for right-handed people, language is typically in the left hemisphere for most lefties too. But you know, so say you have like something that does a lot of damage to your left hemisphere, well, then you're gonna bomb all of the verbal tests and that's not gonna be a good assessment of someone's IQ anymore.
Right, yeah.
Even with that, if you've got, let's say the baseline is 100 and you're, you know, 70, 75 after a traumatic injury to your left hemisphere because you're bombing all these verbal things. And they're like, well, you know, originally, like you should have had about 100 or 105. And you know, maybe the reality with the severity of the illness is that you should have had 120. Like they're guessing, right, essentially. Or the flip side, that maybe you weren't that great at verbal ability beforehand and you were at a 90, and they're kind of overestimating it. And so they're either, because it's like, I guess part of where that problematic nature comes from is it's a lot of guesswork as opposed, yep, to more hardline evidence, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, obviously we can't do like an evaluation on every human and know, okay, this is what your baseline is. So in the future, if anything ever starts going wrong, we'll have like a really good baseline to compare it to and understand what's going on. Like that's not realistic, but yeah. But I think that approach is not the most useful and it's not, yeah, it's got problems.
So you do teach the assessment course at Highlands.
Not the IQ assessment, but yes.
Not the IQ assessment. No. Okay, well, I guess that leads to my question is, what is it like being in a class for assessment? Because I have not taken my last clinical class was as an undergrad and it was like intro to clinical counseling. And we talked about like big picture theories and we didn't really get into any nitty gritty. So can you kind of give me a peek into what that class is like? What are the goals of that class? What is it like being a student in that kind of class?
Sure. Should I take a guess of what it's like in the IQ assessment since that's on topic, or should I tell you what I actually know about my classes?
Oh, we can start with your class and then speculate. We'll track down someone who teaches IQ and grill them.
I just feel so bad. I'm like, I'm on here to talk about IQ assessment. And I'm like, well, I'll try, but that's not what I'm going to talk about most of the time.
I learned about IQ in a regular like assessments and measures course. So I would imagine that like as a master's level student, it's probably very similar. It's just, it's almost like hyper-focused on kind of one core concept as opposed to being more broadly about assessment in general.
Yeah, that's probably true. So in my assessment classes, there's kind of a theoretical foundation. And in neuropsych, it's, you know, a lot of that is tied to the biological research. And then I kind of break it down into different cognitive constructs like memory, processing speed, and relate those to the systems in the brain, because we're trying to move away from phrenology, not just talking about brain regions, but systems of the brain that are working together to produce these important functions. And then I teach tests that measure those different constructs, and the kids, the students, practice the tests on each other. Sorry, it's so offensive. They're not kids. You get to your 40s and everyone's kids. The students practice the tests on each other, and then they practice kind of writing up the results of it, and they have to score them and norm them, and, you know, so that they're all doing, calculating Z-scores using a normal curve and, and then at the end of the course, so we kind of go week by week, the different cognitive constructs, and then talk about putting it all together and seeing the patterns. How do we put all of the different results together and see patterns that are meaningful? Because that's most of what we do is just pattern recognition. And then how do we tie that into things that are useful, like either in diagnosing disorders or in talking about functional implications and how you can use your strengths to compensate for weaknesses. So it's kind of, it's a lot of practice. It's a lot of learning tests and practicing and a lot of Z-score calculation. So it's heavy on the math, but it's just one equation over and over and over again.
You should take that before stats class. Get Z scores better.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they'll know Z scores so well by the end of next semester. They'll dream about Z scores.
See, that's very
good dreams.
Very different from, like, my assessment was more like general how we actually measure. There's a lot of like measurement, like survey-esque measurement.
Yeah.
We never really went into the more clinical side, even though our instructor had a clinical background. And so that's really fascinating that they're delving into not just sort of like how to put a survey together, but how to actually kind of utilize and engage in these in-person cognitive assessments that kind of go beyond, for in this case, clinical students. I'd imagine that should be pretty close to something like an IQ, where you have to kind of look at the score and how it relates mm-hmm. to, I mean, for IQ down to, I think it's like, isn't like the month that the person's born, like in some, like, cause I know it's.
Oh, for children. Yeah. Yeah. For the WISC and probably the Young of the Woodcock Johnson, probably the Stanford-Binet, you do look at that. I don't do assessments with children, so I don't think about that stuff much, but yeah, I think it is.
And for adults, it's at least a year. With trying to kind of determine where they sit on that standard distribution.
And yeah. So,
yeah, I could see that there'd be a lot of similarities in how a kind of repeated practice and scoring and going through would be very similar to understanding an IQ test.
Yeah. And with an IQ test, it's nice because it's like one set where you have one normative standard, and it's like all of the tests are scored in exactly the same way. And you have like one norm book that has all of the kind of conversions. With neuropsych, it's a little bit more challenging for students to learn because there's so many, all the tests, oftentimes many tests use different normative groups, and most of them do Z scores, but then there's some T scores and, you know, other kinds of standardized scores. So it's, yeah, a little bit more of a hassle. But yeah, I think that it is really similar. We talk about psychometrics too, and how, you know, we kind of impose this normal curve. So we can talk about all the problems with IQ assessment and neuropsych assessment. And here's one, like we kind of assume and impose this normal distribution. But man, I do a lot of neuropsych research. Well, not a lot, but when I do neuropsych research, those distributions do not look like the nice, pretty distributions that we base all of our numbers on. And so like, it really changes your interpretation of a test. If someone is like in the really impaired range, but you know that that test distribution is incredibly leptocurtic, well, that might mean they're just made a little bit, you know, just did a little bit worse than someone who was within the average range. But because it's such a leptocurtic distribution, it really makes them look incredibly impaired. So yeah, we talk about psychometrics too, and how that influences the way that we interpret the test scores, even if, you know, the Z score looks really bad or really good. What does that mean? Mm.
It might not be as extreme as it looks.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's definitely on brand for us. It's like, those are important concepts, and especially important to impart, that, you know, we should always kind of take that step back and look at our distributions and the distributions of the data that we're collecting, because like nothing's rarely ever perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's like especially important with fields like IQ and neuropsychology, where people think, like, especially with neuropsychology, it's like you've got all this biological research that's kind of seems to be supporting it. And, you know, it does, but there's problems too. And you've got math, and people hear biology and they hear math and they think you're speaking truth with a capital T. And they think, you know, they kind of lose sight of context and all of the things that really create nuance to the big picture. And I try not to let students miss that in their awe of biology and math.
Mm-hmm. And that's really at the heart of why I get critical. It's just because like people do approach that with big T. So I'm like, we need to bring it back down to little T. It's evidence, not proof.
It is. Anytime I say, or anytime I hear someone say, oh, and that proves this, it's like, it seems like you might not know how science works.
Surprise. Well, this has been very heartening for me running this teaching cognition, because I've been keeping them out of like the muck and grime of methods and like heavy things in that way, like the little bitty details. And we've mostly focused on like big picture, like philosophy of the self. What is the mind? How are things working? And so knowing that the assessment class is going into like, this is how we test this particular function, I'm like, oh, great. Cool. Then like I can do big picture. Laura could do little picture.
I'm so glad you're teaching that class too. When I first came to Highlands, I was teaching that class and I'm like, I don't really know how to be a cognitive psychologist, so I'm going to teach this like a neuropsychologist. And those poor students, like I remember one of the students was like, these articles, I just don't understand this article. And it's like, I took a step back and I was like, yeah, that's fair.
I had to follow suit with Daniel, and I've actually had to cut some this semester. I was like, you know what?
That was after my advice. That's a lot. Because I did the same thing going into my first semester teaching memory and cognition on the graduate level. And I was like, we're going to talk about some of the big theory stuff. And they were like, we don't understand what Bartlett is saying in this 1932 paper. It's talking in old speak. And
I know, I love those old articles though.
And I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, and I went back through and read it. I'm like, yeah, no, 1932 psych papers are really confusing from like a 2020 perspective. Like, okay, we can go back to the drawing board on some of these articles, but it has kind of forced me to like find some of those good like theoretical conceptual and like some of the stuff that's out there, like getting to branch out, though taking a very social cognitive route.
I'm running into the upper limit on that one, because we keep running into issues like, what does this mean? Is this even right? This researcher over here just like wrote a diss track over this theory that we spent a week studying. What does that mean? And so next week we start embodied and extended cognition, and I introduced it yesterday, and I was like, all right, everything we just learned, we're about to throw out the window and start with a new paradigm. And one student who we all know and I assume love, I love her, she's like, so why did we spend the last 2 weeks reading that then? And I was like,
Thomas Kuhn and paradigm shifts and how they move science forward.
Yep, we need to know what happened, where we're at, and where we're going. And they're all conflict.
They're going to be so happy to get through that. And then they're going to join me for social psychology in the spring. And I'm going to go, what we just learned doesn't matter. There's this new thing.
And then they take class with me and I'm like, I'm going to teach you what we know now and how to do these tests, and you're going to feel like you know things, and then all of our knowledge is going to change, and the stuff I'm taught you, we're not even going to use these tests anymore, and our understanding of the brain is going to totally change.
Yeah, I have noticed a nice track between Laura's, yours, and my class, because last Wednesday we talked about expertise and someone brought the expertise of Scrabble players. And they did a bunch of verbal intelligence tests on the Scrabble players. And one of the students was like, oh, we talked about all of this in Dr. Heflin's class last time. And everybody's like, oh yeah, we did. And then they like scaffold your class into my class to talk about the article.
Cool.
And I was like, yes, yes, this is perfect.
That's fantastic. I don't even remember what they're talking about, but I'm sure we did talk. Like, that sounds like something we'd talk about.
So that's happened several times. So the communication between classes is going very well.
Good. I feel like we all share a common value in teaching the process of science too, which can be frustrating for students who are like, just tell me the stuff. I just want to know the stuff so I can go out and do the thing. And it's like, well, that's going to change all the time. Like, so you need to understand the tenets of science and how to use it and digest it, because this, like, if we just teach you the stuff, well, that's going to be outdated in 5 years and 10 years.
you know, kind of pull us back to intelligence, that's a perfect example of intelligence testing. I mean, you go back to Binet and these early examples and what they were used for, and then that gets kind of modified. And it seems to be to make good sense when we're kind of giving these tests in like the 40s. And then it turns out, no, we're not using them. It's not necessarily the tests, but it's the way that they're being implemented. And we get this broader understanding. And that even like taking them today, and that we can be so hypercritical on a modern IQ test, but basically getting that insight from how neuropsychologists use the subtests and the components and adding the process or kind of utilizing them in I want to say, I mean, unique ways than what we would kind of consider a standard IQ test being used really kind of, you know, adds to that. I mean, it really makes me as a non-cognitive researcher say, like, I could use those subtests as part of another study to see, you know, how something might impair or promote, you know, a score on one of these subtests if we were to prime a particular thought or put them in a particular social situation or challenge something, that they have this, you know, what's the word, I'm like a heuristic value, that they're good beyond what we're necessarily normally using them for.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with that. Like, they do have some value. I often struggle with the construct of intelligence. For some of the reasons that we talked about. And then two, it's like so culturally bound, like the things that we value and that help our children succeed in school. Like, first of all, it's just measuring the cognitive stuff. It's not measuring any of the social and emotional stuff that actually some research has suggested is pretty darn important for success in school and later life, but we're just gonna totally ignore that. So it's like, you know, there's all of these kind of cultural expectations and values in how we define intelligence and really focusing on just the cognitive part. But there is still some usefulness. I mean, just because it's limited doesn't mean it's useless. Mm-hmm. You just have to know the limits and not think that we're getting information we're not getting.
Mm-hmm. You have to know the utility of what you're using.
Yeah.
Hmm. That could be, I mean, we could talk probably into another podcast episode about what is the self and what is intelligence and do we have personalities?
I love that. Like, and metacognition, gosh, and personality and psychopathology, like that's a whole other field. And yeah, I mean, social psychology really has, you know, it's kind of comes into conflict. Like, yes, do we have unique personalities? We like to think so. And we think mm-hmm. that people have different personalities, but, you know, social context matters so much. Mm-hmm.
When personality theorists shift to state and trait, we were all very happy in social psychology.
Yeah.
We were like, at least you acknowledge it. And it's so funny because we're in the same APA division. Oh, yeah. And so we are just...
Do you know why are they grouped together? That has always befuddled me. Like, they seem like when I teach
personality... They're just like, these are the people who do survey research. We're going to throw them in a collective together and then they're just going to hate each other.
I don't know. That's a good common denominator. Because, like, it's so funny when I teach personality assessment, which is really a psychopathology assessment. They're like, well, what do you think about social stuff? And I'm like, well, that's valid too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I'm going to have to walk the line pretty heavy when I get into personality. Because I'm like, okay, we ascribe a lot of essential meaning to a lot of things. What does it mean to even have a disordered personality?
Oh my God, that language. Yeah.
So it'll be.
I find that language so problematic.
Same. I'm excited to indulge the students in that conversation, though. It'll be way fun.
Just teach them all about it and then be like, all of that was wrong.
All of that was wrong. Surprise, this is a social psych course.
You cannot trust the social psychologists. That's what decades of social psychology research have taught students.
Never trust them. And never pick up a dollar bill in front of a building. Somebody's watching. And they've got a clipboard. I think we are near time.
I think I should conclude with our bias of the week. So every week we pick a bias from this big old list of biases that we have. I think there's like 130 of them on there. And so this season, because we're doing cognitive psychology, I think with the exception of like one or two episodes, all of our biases are brought to you by Kahneman and Tversky, because they just have so many. And I'm down to my last two. We have three episodes left. I only have two Kahneman and Tversky biases left. And I don't know what I'm going to do for that last episode. But our Kahneman and Tversky bias of the week is the gambler's fallacy. Can't really find anything that like directly fits into what we're talking about anymore, because I've only got two left. It's gambler's fallacy and hot hand fallacy. And they're both kind of similar. But Tversky and Kahneman, 1971, the tendency to think that future probabilities are altered by past events. And so if I have not won a hand, I'm going to win. Karma, you know, fate, whatever it may be, is going to catch up to me, and I'm going to get that good day in the future, when in reality, they're ultimately unchanged. It's not how probability works. Or it could be the reverse, the tendency to believe that future probabilities are changed by past events. So if you win in the past, you're not going to win that next hand because you've already kind of used up all your good luck. And it turns out that no matter how you're thinking about it, it's wrong.
This is kind of on the spot, but are there any neuropsych research in relation to gambler's fallacy or any other biases that you can think of? Because I haven't made the jump.
Maybe to... not. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just, I'm word vomiting.
Well, maybe not in relation to the fallacy, but definitely there are groups of neuropsychologists and kind of related researchers who really like studying gambling decision making and like the kind of the role of the parts of the brain involved in like risk aversiveness and, you know, high risk, high reward versus like low risk, moderate reward, and you know, who pulls from what deck. So there's definitely research that looks into how people gamble in different ways, like in smart but not exciting ways versus exciting but you're going to lose more money ways. But I don't know about as far as like the actual gambler's fallacy. I don't know.
I mean, is like what you described, is that kind of like prefrontal lobe, or is there some other aspect like we're dealing with like emotion centers and I don't know, maybe some dopamine release or something like that, that's kind of like embedded into all of that?
Yeah, it's all of that. I mean, like definitely the frontal lobes are really heavily involved, but also dopamine is definitely, I mean, anytime you're talking about, you know, gambling and rewards, yeah, you got to be thinking about dopamine. But you know, the prefrontal cortex is, it's connected to like everywhere else in the brain. That's how it modulates everything else. So you can't talk about it in isolation, but yeah, that's what they're looking at.
Awesome. I have one last question before we close. This is something that usually we ask before the bias of the week, but I forgot, and so I'm asking it for you now. For an undergrad in psych who's super interested in IQ or any sort of assessment, and they're like, I'm going to grad school, what do you think their dissertation is going to look like 6 years down the road, 10 years down the road? What is the research in this area that the up-and-comers will be working on?
I mean, probably distance delivery of IQ assessments and the validity and reliability of delivering IQ assessments at a distance. The pandemic has made the need for that really apparent. And there's been some research beforehand on doing that, but even so, there was often like a technician. It was like for rural settings delivery, but there was usually still a technician there who had some stimuli. And I think we're going to have to think about having computerized tests to minimize administrator error that can be delivered from a distance that will help, you know, obviously in situations like this when everyone's so socially isolated, but also that will reach people in rural parts of the country where there are not a lot of people who are qualified to administer the assessments. So I think that that's a place of a lot of research right now.
Excellent.
And cultural adaptations. I think we have a long, long, long way to go to make IQ tests and neuropsych tests more culturally thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. That was a can of worms I wanted to wait for another episode. I was going to ask, but I was culturally like, yeah.
Oh my God. It is such a huge can of worms. I mean, I lose sleep over it.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is that the undergrad psych student needs to make friends with the computer science undergrad student and go to grad school together.
Yeah. Yep.
I think there's some potential for a VR IQ test.
Ooh.
I think that would be, because like if you have to manipulate blocks and you want to do that, that would even be better for assessment too, because you could record the whole thing very easily. Instead of having all external system, it's all within the internal system.
Mm.
Fascinating. We know some people with a VR rig.
We do.
I don't know. This is one more thing to add to my list of like ideas to get involved in.
Future projects.
So yeah, well, thank you, Lara, for joining us and sharing your expertise. It's so awesome.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, my expertise, such as it is, it's limited on IQ tests.
It's better than
you
us.
Are miles closer to where we are.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, thank you.
So with that, we'll bid our listeners farewell.
Good night.